Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, could higher entrance fees for international visitors make some national parks less attractive for those tourists?
And the merits of housing first to address homelessness, which the Trump administration has attacked.
But first, the state legislature doesn't start its new session for another month or so, but lawmakers are already filing bills in preparation, and they deal with a wide range of issues. With me to take a look at some of them is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. And Howie, first off, what exactly are these pre-filed bills? How does that work?
Well, lawmakers have the option of getting all their brilliant ideas out and on paper before anyone else comes back. And sometimes they want to be the first or second ones out there. The fact is, in general, the earlier a bill is filed, the more likely it gets in the pipeline faster. Therefore, the more likely it is to get an early hearing, which can be important because toward the end of the session, things sort of get gummed up. Obviously, it's no guarantee of passage. It's not even a guarantee of being heard. But the idea is, let's get some things in. Now, the other half of the equation is that both the House and Senate have firm bill limits after a certain date, usually sometime in February. So the more you get in now, you don't hit your bill limit after, you know, the certain date in February where you're only allowed to file, let's say, seven more bills. So you've got a lot of people who just love filing bills. John Kavanaugh is probably number one. He filed probably a dozen bills, you know, already this session, and he just always has an idea if something needs to be fixed.
Well, so let's talk about one of those ideas he has, which deals with bicycles that apparently are going too fast for his liking.
Well, yeah, I mean, it makes him sound like one of those folks, you know, walking along the sidewalk saying, "You miserable kids, get off of my sidewalk," and things like that. There's probably a real problem. I don't doubt, and I've probably been in situations where kids are speeding by on a sidewalk, not just on regular bicycles, but on electric bicycles and electric scooters and things like that. Fact is, if you are going more than 15 miles an hour, you probably should be riding in the street. I realize that's more dangerous, but you know, you've got people using the sidewalks for other purposes. You know, same thing with bridle paths and everything else. So his idea is to say, if in fact you're just riding along, 15 miles an hour is enough. I don't know where he got that number. It you know, may just seem to be reasonable. I don't even know how fast folks travel when they're just normally bicycling on the sidewalk. You know, these aren't the folks who are training for some great race. The more interesting part says, and if you're passing someone else, another bicycle or pedestrian, you have to slow to 5 miles an hour. Now, I don't know, A, how somebody knows they're at 5 miles an hour versus six or seven, and B, how does the bicycle stay up? If you're on a two-wheeled bike, do you fall over at 5 miles an hour?
Yeah.
And then the problem C, of course, is does anybody really believe that the police in Scottsdale or Fountain Hills or Avondale are going to be out there with their radar guns checking on this?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair question. So, Howie, let me ask you also, speaking of John Kavanaugh and his 89 colleagues in the legislature, there's a proposal to give them a pay raise, which they've not had in many, many years, but it seems to come with a bit of a catch.
Well, there are two versions. The John Kavanaugh version has no catch other than you need voter approval for a pay raise. It says, let's take the $24,000 a year that voters approved in 1998, and we will adjust it since then for inflation. And if voters approve, we will then use that as a new starting point for automatic inflation indexes. Now, that would take it directly to $48,000 a year. He actually got that bill out of the Senate last year and never got a House vote. A lot of political reasons for that. I'm not sure, quite frankly, that voters going into a voting booth are going to say, we understand this is just an inflation adjustment, but we're not quite ready to double the salaries of lawmakers. So Representative Stacey Travers from Phoenix, who's a Democrat, has an alternate plan. Let's go to $35,000, which is not quite the inflation indexing from 1998. But I'll tell you what, we're going to offer a sweetener here for some of you folks who may not be happy with lawmakers. We're going to offer true term limits. Now, you may remember back in 1992, we enacted term limits legislation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 8 years, 4 terms in the House, 4 terms in the Senate. and theoretically you would be gone. But there's a loophole. You can go back and forth. So you can do your 4 years in the House, do 4 years in the Senate, and then go back and do 4 years in the House. We have several lawmakers, including said Mr. Kavanaugh, who have been around for a lot more than the 16 years. And she's saying, why does anybody need to be here for 16 years? We need some fresh blood. And so her proposal, assuming it A, gets a hearing, and B, is approved, and C, is approved by the voters, would say, we'll do 35,000, but you can be guaranteed no lawmaker will serve more than 16 years where they've been in and out and in and out. That's it. 16 years and you're done.
So, Howie, we talked about two-wheel modes of transportation a moment ago. Let's talk about four-wheel modes of transportation for just a moment. There's a proposal that would lower the age when new drivers could start getting their learner's permits. Is that right?
That's it. Right now, it's at 15 and a half. And it used to be, in fact, that you couldn't really get the permit till you were 16. They figured at 15 and a half, you're supposed to be driving with an adult in the car. And you're supposed to use that term, that time, to go ahead and learn the rules of the road. The idea by Representative Cupper is we'll give kids another 6 months of training that they can do. And the assumption is, well, if they've got another 6 months, they'll actually have 6 months more of supervised driving. Now, there's folks like from the Insurance Information for Highway Safety who say, but that's not necessarily true, because the law only requires a certain number of hours of training, whether it's by mom and dad or by a driving instructor. And so simply saying, we're going to have you on the road for 6 more months, they're not convinced that, in fact, it will make safer drivers. And they contend that the earlier you get a learner's permit, the more accidents that occur.
So, Howie, let me ask you about one other bill that has been pre-filed that would also affect younger people, not quite as young as those getting their driver's license or learner's permits. But there's an idea that would exempt people under a certain age, if they are married, from paying state income taxes.
Exactly. This is an idea by Representative Rachel Keschel from Tucson. And it seems to be she is trying to encourage marriage. Because right now, at whatever age you start making money, you start paying taxes. That's the nature of it. So her proposal says anyone who is 25 or younger, who is married to somebody else who is 25 or younger, they would pay no state income tax on anything they earn. Doesn't matter how much they earn. If they somehow have figured out how to make $200,000 a year at age 24, and of course, in the dot-com era, that could be possible, they don't owe anything to the state. This is another bit of social engineering. I mean, we've got several bills that are designed to promote adoption, to promote women keeping their babies versus aborting them. And then this one is the idea that somehow the state is better off if people are married. Again, another piece of debate at the legislature. It should be fascinating when they start deciding, well, what is the proper age that people should be married? And is any of the state's business?
Absolutely. Should be interesting. Well, all these bills will be interesting to follow as they move through the process. All right. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, terrific as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Last month, the Department of Housing and Urban Development announced deep cuts to permanent housing programs for people experiencing homelessness. The feds wanted to shift the money to transitional housing programs with work or service requirements. It was a pulling back from so-called housing first programs that put people experiencing homelessness into housing without requiring them to find a job or get treatment for substance abuse or something like that first. HUD called it a failed ideology and they pulled the funding. Well, that was met with a barrage of lawsuits, including from Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays and other states' attorneys general who sued over the cuts. Now HUD is temporarily pausing the plan, but they say they still intend to do it in the future. The funding overhaul would have had major implications here in Arizona. Leaders warned it would put 1,400 housing units for the formerly homeless at risk in Maricopa County. And according to our next guest, the announcement left them scrambling to figure out how many people in HUD-funded housing would lose it. Nathan Smith is the CEO of Central Arizona Shelter Services. I spoke with him more about these impending changes before the administration put them on hold, and he told me he was willing to see if it worked.
One of the things that I think the administration is doing is it's focusing very heavily on a particular and very visible group of people who are experiencing homelessness, the ones that are at the intersections, they're folks who are panhandling. Every time you get off the freeway, at every freeway exit, you're going to see someone panhandling, it feels like.
Yeah.
Those folks often have higher rates of substance use disorder, mental illness, even serious mental illness, than many others, say families or older adults in the homeless population. So what I think we're doing is focusing on a very specific subset of people experiencing homelessness.
Yeah.
That said, I think there is some merit to saying if you're receiving these services – and we're experiencing returns to homelessness from these housing projects at rates that are disappointing to us,
yeah,
then we're going to switch some things up. So the administration is saying you're going to switch some things up. On the other end, I think it's a gamble because oftentimes requiring people to participate in treatment services isn't the best way to get them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You want people to self-select to go into these services, and now we're going to force them. The incarceration system does that all the time. Hey, you're on probation. You got to participate in these services in order to get off probation. You know, so those probationary requirements do exist for people.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those people have experienced homelessness. But it's not known to be the best way to get people to participate. So I think I'm willing to say, let's see if this works. Let's see if our returns to homelessness go down. Let's see if meaningful participation in behavioral health and substance use services goes up.
Okay.
But I think there's rightly some skepticism as to whether it'll be effective.
What do those return to homelessness rates look like?
So I think for us in Maricopa County, and this would need a refresher, but we're roughly in the maybe 30% range.
Okay.
And yeah, I think we would want to see those numbers go down. That's something that we've been wanting as a community for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
The administration is saying, here's how that's going to happen.
Right.
And again, there are questions as to whether that's going to work, but either way, we're going to have to give it a try and see what happens.
Right. I mean, the underlying assumption here, right, is that the root cause of homelessness is substance abuse or addiction or mental health issues, like almost this idea that like if people wanted to get out of homelessness, they could. We're just not making them do it.
Yeah. Now, that's where I think the biggest issue comes in. And that's where I think this has this approach has some weakness and potential to fail. The root cause of homelessness, if you're looking for a single thing, the root cause of homelessness is economic in nature. It's the problem of rising costs of living pushed heavily by rising costs of housing,
mm-hmm,
and not being matched by rise in wages at a quick enough pace. So that's what's causing homelessness more than anything else. It's certainly not the only set of factors, but it's a huge one. So here's my take on it. If we were to heal all the mental illness problems, heal all the substance use disorder problems, you would have a bunch of sober and mentally well people experiencing homelessness.
It wouldn't
still
go away.
It wouldn't go away. Mm-hmm. You'd still be on the streets and they would just be better on the streets. Versus if you put all of our resources and energy and attention or a heavier percentage of it into addressing the economic problems that we continue to face all across the country, especially in big cities, including in Phoenix,
yeah,
then you would have a bunch of people who may not be fully well from a substance use standpoint and maybe have some untreated mental illness, but they would be housed and they would be in position to then take advantage of those services.
Okay. So what if – or I guess what are the ways in which this could work? How do you have to do it right, to try to keep people in housing with these requirements involved?
That is an incredibly important question. So one of the things that will happen naturally is our caseload sizes will increase.
Mm-hmm.
As it is today, organization that provides permanent housing programs to people only has the people on their caseloads who want to be on those caseloads. Now it's going to be everybody has to be on that caseload. So what we've done is we've made it more expensive to offer that intervention. Again, that may or may not be the best approach, but it is certainly going to be more expensive.
So you just have to have a lot more people working with people experiencing homelessness because
mm-hmm,
they have to meet these requirements. That takes work and manpower. What about the way the care is offered or the way the treatment's offered, like the way that you approach the whole thing?
So one of the things that you'll have to do as a provider offering these sorts of services is you're going to have to really focus heavily on treatment compliance,
mm-hmm,
meaning people are actually using the service. And so this is speculative, but I imagine agencies will be wrestling with a shorter leash for people who are not complying with the stipulations of their case plan. And it's potentially going to be the case that you're facing having to exit people from a program because of their lack of participation in these services. And that's what's really unfortunate, because now you've got, for any number of reasons, and honestly, some of them very valid, people not taking advantage of a service that's offered to them. Mm-hmm. But as a result of that, they're going to be potentially facing homelessness again.
That just repeats the cycle. I've done interviews on the show before about trauma-informed care when it comes to people experiencing homelessness, especially because that so often is a part of why people are experiencing homelessness, that they've experienced significant trauma in their lives. Mm-hmm. Can you do trauma-informed care when it's something that they are going to be mandated to do, to take these offered treatments?
You absolutely can. You can do trauma-informed care in almost any setting, no matter how disadvantageous it is to a trauma-informed approach. And it can be as simple as the way that we create an assessment, mm-hmm. Or an assessment process doesn't ask the same question about, you know, how your life impacted your substance use disorder over and over and over and over again. Asking somebody to revisit that history in an assessment process over and over again is re-traumatizing.
Yeah.
So you can still say, we're going to implement a process by which we'll gather information as to people's history and how it's impacting their mental illness and their substance use disorder. But you can do that in a trauma-informed way. The person sitting on the other side of the individual receiving services can do their level best to create a non-threatening and non-judgmental environment for this conversation. That is a trauma-informed approach. So we won't take the foot off the gas on trauma-informed approaches. Mm-hmm. We just overall, some of the things have been impacted. I think a truly trauma-informed approach doesn't require people to participate in services that they don't want to participate in.
Right. Because, I mean, like anybody who has ever had a family member or a friend or somebody go through like a substance abuse issue knows that like you can't force them to do it, to fix it. You kind of have to wait for them to be ready. Mm-hmm. Is that trauma-informed to force them?
That component by itself, I think many would argue, is not trauma-informed. Mm. And I would lean in that direction with them. So that component is taken off the table. Right. And now we've got to be trauma-informed within that new context.
Sure. And you think you can do that?
I think we can do it on the whole. I think we can implement trauma-informed practices, like I was mentioning before. But I don't think that it will be as trauma-informed as it would have been otherwise. On the other side, we're going to see if it reduces waste.
Right.
Are we spending less money on people who are ultimately going to return to homelessness mm-hmm. anyway? Are we spending less money on programs that may not be working in terms of helping people get off the streets and stay off the streets?
Yeah.
You know, jury's out. It's a social experiment in some ways.
Yeah.
But to answer your question again purely, yeah, we have a less trauma-informed context to work in, but we can still be trauma-informed.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Nathan Smith, CEO of Central Arizona Shelter Services, joining us. Thank you so much, Nathan. Appreciate it.
It was an honor to be here. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a popular podcast explores the boundaries between science and the paranormal. It's been accused of spreading misinformation. We'll sit down with the host of the wildly successful and controversial podcast.
But first, starting in the new year, the Trump administration is making it more expensive for international visitors to go to a number of national parks, including the Grand Canyon. The Interior Department says foreign tourists will be charged $250 for an America the Beautiful Pass, which the agency describes as providing access to more than 2,000 recreation areas managed by six federal agencies. The same pass costs $80 for Americans. International visitors who just show up at the entrance gate at the Grand Canyon and the nine other parks will have to pay $100 per person to get in. Right now, the charge is $35 per vehicle.
Our national parks, especially in the West, are one of the main reasons, you know, international visitors come here. They want to go to those kinds of places that, you know, that they don't really have at home.
That's Kathleen Anderek, a professor in ASU School of Community Resources and Development, which includes the tourism program. She says it may take a little while to get a real sense of the impact of this change, since tourism at many national parks really starts to pick up in the spring. I spoke with her earlier about the higher entrance fees for international visitors at the 10 parks.
Tourism is subject to a lot of outside forces that doesn't really have very much to do with, you know, the management of tourism. And certainly one of the main ones is political policy. And that can be policy related to visas, immigration, you know, prices. All of those things are part of it. And tourists are particularly concerned about value for money. So prices are a huge part of their decision-making process when they decide where they're going to go. So typically increase in price means a decrease in demand. It's not unusual for national parks in a variety of countries to charge visitors from other countries more than charging residents. But the reason for it is different than this. This tends to be more, at least it would appear on the surface, to be more about, you know, getting additional money out of international visitors, where in most countries, it's kind of the other way around. It's less about income from international visitors is about making prices affordable for residents. So that's one thing that we kind of see going on. Another thing is that tourists are particularly concerned about safety. So some of the things that we've been seeing going on with immigration rates and so forth, especially for someone from another country, doesn't feel very safe and secure. Another thing that we see is that, you know, people want to go places where they feel welcome. And the issues related to visas and increasing prices, you know, are making people feel like we really don't want them here. And I don't think that's true, at least not from the tourism industry, but that is a perception out there. And, you know, there's a lot of competition. There's a lot of choices, including for national parks. And if they're feeling like, you know, prices are too high here, they're feeling like their safety is compromised and they're not feeling very welcome, they'll just pick another place to go.
Do you think that tourists make the distinction between why, you know, international visitors might be paying more than resident or citizen visitors? As you reference, is it a matter of trying to keep the parks affordable for people who live there versus just trying to get more money out of international tourists? I'm just wondering, like in this case, will visitors say, well, yes, they're charging me more and it's because of this reason I don't like, so I'm not going to go, as opposed to, well, they're trying to keep it, you know, affordable for people who live there, so that's fine, we'll just pay it.
No, I don't think it will be perceived that way. It, you know, a national park, you know, the bigger parks like the Grand Canyon, are, you know, $80 to go in. So they're far from being inexpensive for residents. When we're talking about the differential in prices, we're talking about a very minimal or zero entry fee for residents in countries where people really can't afford those kinds of prices. So no, I definitely think it's going to be viewed more as a way to just get money, more money out of international visitors. Certainly the parks could use funding. You know, they're quite underfunded, and there's a huge, you know, maintenance backlog. I'm sure you've heard that, you know, the Grand Canyon is, the South Rim is somewhat closed at the moment because of the breaks in the water main, and it's going to cost a fortune to fix that. But so there's a lot of things kind of at play here, but considering a lot of the other policies that have been happening over the past year or so, I really do think that international visitors are viewing it as just getting more money and that we really tend to not want them.
Do you see it as significant that international visitors will be paying per person in addition to a higher fee? Because typically when you drive into a national park, you pay one fee for the car, regardless of how many people are inside of it.
That is correct. And normally it's one fee for a few days. It's not just for one entry. And it is for the car. The fees they're talking about, you know, if a family's visiting, you know, they're not going to pay those fees. It's just, you know, it's just too much. So I think this is going to be, you know, kind of bad news for international visitors. And, you know, you could always make the case too, Mark, that, you know, a lot of our parks are over-visited, and you could make the case that maybe this will be a partial fix to that over-tourism problem. But there's a lot of other implications for communities near these parks that are pretty heavily reliant on visitors, and that includes international visitors. So, so by and large, on the balance, at least my personal opinion is this is not a good thing.
So you reference the situation at the South Rim of the Grand Canyon. I want to ask you about that sort of in the context of these fee changes and, of course, the context of the fire that burned down the lodge on the North Rim earlier this mm-hmm. year. What does all of that mean, both for Grand Canyon National Park and, as you alluded to, you know, some of the towns, Tusayan and others that are right outside the park that are pretty heavily reliant on tourism and their dollars?
Yeah, that is true. I would say, you know, the fee increase, sort of setting that aside for the time being with the, you know, water being shut off. It's possible that's good for Tusayan and Williams, right? Because maybe more people will stay there because that's going to be the option. But those places fill up kind of fast, though. So in the short term, you know, it's still going to be, you know, bad for tourism. And certainly the North Rim, you know, that's kind of a whole other story with mm-hmm. the fire and the lodge burning down and the entire area being closed off for so long. And of course, now it's closed for winter because they close in the winter up there. But so the Grand Canyon is likely to have, you know, a declining visitation and the communities nearby are likely to, you know, suffer a bit from that.
Do you think that this all might have an impact on the state more broadly, given the importance of tourism to the economy? And as you're suggesting, given the idea that there may be fewer international visitors coming here, does that have any implication for the state overall?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, a lot of we get a lot of tax revenue for visitors, and that doesn't matter too much, you know, where they are. If they're up in northern Arizona, you know, that tax revenue comes into the state's coffers. And a lot of people who go to the canyon and some other areas like that come, you know, fly into Phoenix, and they may end up spending some, you know, time down here too. And just, you know, the downturn in international visitors, just in general, just kind of not even considering the impact of national parks, with that downturn is going to absolutely affect us, you know, pretty much all over the state. And people who come to the resorts in southern Arizona, we're just very unlikely to see, you know, the same numbers of international visitors that we've been seeing over the past few years.
All right. Kathleen, thanks as always for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Nice to talk to you.
Kathleen Andereck is a professor in ASU School of Community Resources and Development.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Lots of mailboxes right about now are filling up with holiday cards, including family photos and sometimes updates about who's up to what. And since people seemingly are using AI for pretty much everything else these days, we wondered whether anyone is using the technology to create their holiday cards, and if so, if that's a problem. So we called up Lizzie Post to find out. She's co-president of the Emily Post Institute and co-host of the Awesome Etiquette podcast. She joins me to talk more about this. And Lizzie, I'm curious, are the people who send you holiday cards, are there any that you suspect or just straight up know have used AI?
So I haven't seen them yet, but because of this interview, I am now anticipating them this year. And I have a feeling that if they come, they're going to be very obviously AI enhanced. You know, it would be like someone's head on Arnold Schwarzenegger's body, like coming in for Jingle All the Way Christmas or something like that. Like, I'm picturing things like that, as opposed to maybe just like someone with their, let's just say a single person, like with their dog in a setting that's completely not the place they live in or something like that. You know, it's like, I feel like the idea of the background, or, you know, you go to the store where they're doing the photos in store and they've got four backgrounds you can pick from. Mm-hmm. I think that's not uncommon to have seen over the years, but I could imagine people getting very playful with it, making it look like they're celebrating with certain celebrities, or that they're, you know, like I said, different, your head on someone else's body or something like that. I'll be very curious to see what people go with if they do it.
So, like, I mean, do you think that is okay? Like, is it okay to use AI to generate our holiday cards?
I think when we're not trying to fake them in a way that we're trying to pull the wool over someone's eyes and make it a believable fake, I think that, yes, I think it would be okay. I think there's you know, this component of etiquette that's about honesty and being able to trust someone. And I think that that you want to either very jokingly use the AI where it's obvious that you've used the AI, or you want to move in the other direction of doing something more traditional that's authentic. That said, I'll be very curious what people end up doing if they force the kid who wouldn't wear the Christmas sweater into the Christmas sweater. And how different is that from Photoshopping? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, that's a question, right? Because, you know, when you have a group photo, for example, it's really hard. Anyone who's taken a group photo knows it's really hard to take one where everybody is looking at the camera and everybody's mm-hmm. eyes are open. And mm-hmm. like on a lot of smartphones now, you can just fix that. So like, yeah. is there really a difference between, as you say, between Photoshop or doing something on your phone or asking ChatGPT to create you a holiday card?
Probably not much of one, but I also start to wonder, how does the person who's being changed feel about it? You know, mm-hmm. if it is the kid who is sullen or doesn't like to smile for pictures, how authentic is it to then force one on them? I don't know. I don't know how good I feel about that. Maybe we just let it be that they're not a smiler in photos and we let that be okay, you know?
Yeah. Do you think there's any chance that people will maybe try to use something like ChatGPT for those folks who sort of send an update on their family with a holiday card? Do you get sense that's something people will try to do?
Given all the things people use ChatGPT for, I would say yes. I would definitely expect them to craft me a good, you know, holiday newsletter, that sort of thing. With those holiday newsletters, we always say go back in and make sure that you haven't over-exaggerated or that it's not coming across as like braggadocious. You really want to make sure that you're within the realms of nice, simple, easy, fun, positive things to share. Occasionally people will make note of a hard year or, you know, having lost a few key loved ones or something like that. And that's okay, as long as you don't go into dwelling about it or turning it into a therapy session.
Mm. Well, so yeah, what is the balance on those kinds of newsletters, those kinds of updates? Like, obviously you want to share good stuff. As you say, some people want to share difficult things, but how do you try to make it so that it doesn't sound like you're just bragging on everybody in your family or that you're, you know, really trying to, as you say, use these cards as, you know, as a way of getting some therapy?
I think 1 to 2 sentences on each family member that's in the card, you know, or that the card is quote unquote from, I think really helps. And a good thing to aim for is where are they right now in life? And maybe something exciting, fun that they've done or that they're looking forward to. I adore my godfather's Christmas card each year because he and his wife have a large blended family. And I grew up with that family and I get the update of all the kids, but it's usually those kind of 2 sentences. Where are they? What have they done? Or what are they looking forward to? And then she moves on to the next kid. And okay. I just look forward to that. It's my update on them each year. I really appreciate it.
Well, like in a way, I wonder if those might be, and I hate to use this word, might be becoming somewhat obsolete since it's Maybe. Not that hard to find out about people anymore.
I know. And it's one of those where I don't like to lean into the idea that everybody participates on social media in a way that they just get that information anyway. That might be very biased because I don't participate personally on social media. And so I'm like, I need these updates. Otherwise, I don't know these things.
Yeah.
But I think there's still a lot of warmth and good cheer and good tiding and good, you know, season's greetings to people when we choose to do this in a card form delivered directly to someone's mailbox. Think about how different that is than receiving just bills in December.
Yeah. Well, and I wonder, I was going to ask about how you see the difference between a physical card that you actually put in an envelope with a stamp and an address and put it in the mail versus like an e-card or some kind of electronic photo or even an update from people.
I feel like the e-card can get really lost amid all of the Black Friday sale this and 3 days before Christmas that emails that get flooded to our inboxes. So I am a big fan of actually using the Postal Service to get cards to people's mailboxes specifically or by dropping them off. Maybe it's the kind of thing where you decide to give little holiday gifts to those in your social circle and you bring that card with the gift. I think that's another really nice way to do it. So you don't have to mail every single one. They can be something that you hand to somebody or that you deliver, or even just leave on their little table in their entryway as you come and go from a holiday party or something like that. It is really nice and delightful, and it's something different in your everyday kind of junk mail pile.
So I've got to ask, at some point down the road, will we see, or at least people who get the Lizzie Post holiday card, will it be your face on Arnold Schwarzenegger's body, like going through the chimney?
I really want to see what that looks like. Someone please, if you have AI, draft that up. I would be so, I would just, that would tickle me pink. But no, I tend to want to break out my crafty side. So I don't have a very big list that I send to, but I tend to hand create my cards. And there's usually some glitter and markers or, you know, colored pencils involved. And a few key messages. I like the message of Merry and Bright. That's one of my favorite ones, and having like little string of lights going through it or something.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So it also depends on who's receiving it, right? Like my list isn't only just people who celebrate for Christmas. So so sometimes the theme or the message is a little bit different. But
sure.
I really like to handcraft my cards. I hope that's not too geeky.
All right. That is Lizzie Post, co-president of the Emily Post Institute and co-host of the Awesome Etiquette podcast. Lizzie, terrific as always to talk to you. Thank you.
I love our annual chat, Mark. Thanks so much. Take care.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. The Telepathy Tapes is one of the most successful new podcasts of the last couple of years. The show tells provocative stories about consciousness. In the first season, host Kai Dickens introduced listeners to families of non-speaking autistic children who claimed that their kids were able to communicate telepathically. The second season explores spiritual questions like life after death and clairvoyance. The podcast is undeniably successful. It's been downloaded over 12 million times. And it's also drawn criticism for the questionable science behind the experiences its subjects claim to have had. But that doesn't seem to have slowed its growth. Dickens says she didn't have any budget for advertising when she started. She attributes the show's success to simple word of mouth, listeners discovering the show and feeling compelled to share it with people. So why is the Telepathy Tapes resonating, and what are the stakes of telling stories like this? Our co-host Sam Dingman spoke to Dickens about all of that and more.
I do think that there's a cultural moment where people are kind of tired of binary thinking. For a long time, there's been this binary of this very materialist paradigm that we live in that says, you know, the only things that are real can be measured and observed. But a lot of people have had a strange dream or a simple experience or something that happened when they had a near-death experience that they can't explain. And so we try to talk to really credible scientists, you know, and thoughtful thinkers and people exploring consciousness and lived experience. And in order to give this a thoughtful inquiry, so people have a space to explore these in a way that's not, you know, we're not out there like looking into Bigfoot and fairies. And I think that's the fear, right? If you believe in something, you believe in everything, or that you believe in nothing. And there's no spiritual world, there's no metaphysical world, there's no God. And we say, no, maybe there is a space in between, and that's where most of us live. And what we've learned from the success of the show is I think that's where most people are at.
You talked about the idea that this is a time when people are challenging what you called binary thinking. And I mean, we're obviously in a moment when it comes to medicine and science in particular, which are worlds that come up a lot in your show. Legacy medical wisdom is being called into question at the highest levels of government. It was only a few weeks ago that we had the president of the United States on television repeating unproven claims about a link between Tylenol and autism, and that shocked a lot of people. But I think the calculus of the administration probably was also that there were going to be a good number of people who welcomed that kind of challenge to traditional medical thinking. Do you think there is an attendant interest in the sorts of subjects that you talk about on the Telepathy Tapes that stems from that environment, the rise of things like the Maha movement?
Yeah, I mean, we try to only put stuff out there that is, you know, peer-reviewed research that is scientifically, grounded. And I think especially when it comes to healthcare and psychology and consciousness, there are a lot of explanations that we don't have answers to yet. And I think we're very careful being like, this is a theory. This is what happened. These are all these lived experiences. This is what the researchers who've been spending, you know, years studying this say. But we're very careful to not make a claim, especially around medicine, that can't be proven. And in fact, like right now, the thing I'm editing this week is our upcoming episode on energy healing. And one of the most groundbreaking studies to come out of that field recently was done at MD Anderson, a cancer research institute, extremely well respected. And they had an energy healer working on pancreatic cancer cells, which is one of the cancers most difficult to heal or cure or, you know, even diminish in any way. And the energy healer was able to create extremely positive impacts on the pancreatic cancer cells in a lab. And that research, which is going to be published in a mainstream journal, you know, probably in the next year, is remarkable. We also talked to a Cambridge biologist who thinks that comes down to the mitochondria and maybe linking to our consciousness or greater consciousness or, you know, information. You know, it's unclear yet. But we really try to take a scientific approach to this so that it is grounded, because this show only works if it's grounded in science and experience and saying, we can learn things all sorts of ways through observation, through talking through experience, through looking at research, all of that together.
This makes me think about something that you're actually doing in the literal narration of the show in the second season, which, unless I missed it, I feel like wasn't as present in the first season. And it's an interesting evolution to me, which is you say to the listener often, what if this thing that we're going to talk about in this episode could be true? What if there was some truth to these experiences?
You know, I think we want to present questions and try to bring in not just the most seasoned, credible researchers and authors and people who've investigated this, but also those who've experienced it. And sometimes I think that's missing.
So I have to ask you, though, Kai, because, I mean, you've brought up this idea of credibility a couple times. And as I know you know, the principal scientific source in your first season, Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell, has had her medical license suspended in the past. And one of the folks that you feature in the second season, who's a neurosurgeon named Dr. Eben Alexander, has been sued a number of times for medical malpractice. And those things are not, unless I missed it, something that you necessarily disclose in the show.
Yeah. So Dr. Powell, we do disclose that in the first season.
Okay.
That, you know, when she first released her book called ESP Enigma, she had her license revoked. And, you know, she thinks that it was because you cannot dare, you know, do this, you know, say things that are kind of outside of the current accepted scientific paradigm. And they made her actually go through some psychological evaluations to see if she was sane. And then she got her license back. Of course, she got her license back because she is sane and, you know, she is credible. And that book, you know, is in many university libraries. And, you know, that's one of the things we look at our show is there's a lot of scientists who get, you know, diminished or ridiculed for saying things that might be outside of the paradigm or are, you know, kind of purposely attacked. So we do, you know, like to talk about that.
But did it give you any concerns about these folks as reliable sources? I mean, like, did you feel like you had to do any parallel vetting when you, you know, found out about these incidents in the past of these folks?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, absolutely. My reputation was on the line as well.
Right,
you know?
Of course. And
I think Diane really, Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell, I think she really took unfair punches that was because she was challenging the paradigm. What I started hearing from many scientists is, look, this is not always free and fair when it comes to the work that we're putting out there. There's a lot of tightly controlled special interests that don't want certain things out there.
That's interesting, though, Kai, because, I mean, that language that you were just using, the idea that there are these special interests who are trying to control the flow of information, I mean, those are a lot of the talking points that we hear from folks in the MAHA movement, specifically when it comes to, you know, alleging conspiracies about big pharma and, you know, agriculture companies and these sorts of things. Earlier you said, you know, we do not want to feed into any kind of medical misinformation. Do you ever worry that a project like this is feeding a beast, shall we say, unintentionally?
I don't think so, you know, because like even in our energy healing episode, never in the show do we say only do this. It's like you should – this could be a component along with Western medicine or radiation or chemotherapy, you know, like talk to a doctor. Like you have to be very responsible with this stuff. You can't just – you have to always be thinking for yourself. I think that's a big thing about it, especially now with algorithms that only encourage you to believe what you already believe. And – you know, I try to hire skeptics who really come in to this like with a eyebrow raised. I think all of that is so critical just so that we can keep a very level, grounded, thoughtful approach to questions that have often not been able to be asked.
Well, Kai Dickens is the creator and host of the Telepathy Tapes, currently in season 2. Kai, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Don't forget, you can follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.